Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin with the Civic Center in Roswell, New Mexico. 60 years. It's 1947. Stanton Friedman is our guest. If anybody knows the date, maybe Stanton does. It might have been July 3rd. Maybe it's July 4th. What is the straight scoop here?
I don't know either.
You don't know
it
either.
It had to be the 3rd or the 4th. We know that Mac Brazel, the rancher, went into the town of Corona on Saturday, the 5th. He went in there and was curious about all this junk that was cluttering up his sheep ranch. I mean, his concern was very direct. The sheep wouldn't cross the debris field. They wouldn't go to water, and they better get to water or he's got a problem.
You're going
to
lose them.
Also, sheep eat everything, and if they were going to eat any of this junk that was all over his place, he may lose a few sheep. And he was the manager of the ranch, and so he was concerned about that. And he wasn't thinking in terms of flying saucers. He didn't have a newspaper. He didn't have a radio. He didn't have electricity. He didn't have a telephone. But on Saturday, the 5th, he went into the town of Corona, and that's where everybody else was talking about it. And he had brought along some of the wreckage he'd picked up. It was just oddball stuff. And they were the ones who told him that there was a reward being offered for parts of this, these flying saucers. $3,000. That was a lot of money back then. He didn't have two nickels to rub together, as somebody put it. He was managing the ranch. He didn't own the ranch.
Right, right. He was a working guy.
Yeah, and so they suggested that he go into the sheriff's office and see if he could collect that reward. So the next day, July 6th, he went in there, talks to the sheriff, and the sheriff talks to the base. Now, there was already an agreement between the sheriff's office and the base that anything that might affect the Roswell Army Airfield, the 509th and stuff, they would contact the base. Could be a drunken airman. They wanted good relations with the town. And so calls the base, talks to Major Jesse Marcel, who's the base intelligence officer, who happened to be the duty officer that Sunday. He talks to his boss, Colonel Blanchard. Jesse Marcel goes and looks at some of this stuff. It's obviously strange, and the ranchers had a whole lot of it back there. So Colonel Blanchard, the base commander, orders Jesse to take one of the counterintelligence corps guys and go find out what's given there. Now, that instruction, counterintelligence, the concern was who was spying on the base. This is the home of the only atomic bombing group in the entire world. There were nuclear weapons around here.
And the Cold War was going on.
The Cold War was on, and Colonel Blanchard was very much concerned about. Nobody was thinking of alien space invaders or anything like that. So naturally, they follow orders, and Jesse and Sheridan Cabot follow the rancher out. No way to tell anybody where it was. People think, well, you know, show them a map. It's not on a map. The crash site is, 10 miles from a road, for goodness sakes. So they follow the rancher out, spend overnight in their sleeping bags. The next day, they see this huge debris field, and Jesse is frankly puzzled. If it was an airplane that had crashed, there'd be a big crater because they make a mess when they come down. He figured it had to be an above-air explosion because of the extent of the debris field, like three-quarters of a mile long, a few hundred yards wide. But what really puzzled him was he'd been at airplane crashes before. There was nothing conventional. Where are the vacuum tubes? You know, where are the wires? Where are the little tags that said made in Oshkosh? I mean, the standard stuff that you
right,
see.
Right, right.
You know. So he and Cabot each pick up as much as they could fit in their vehicles. They head on back toward town. Jesse gets in late at night, shows his wife and son. The next morning they go to the base, and we have some new information about what might have happened then. But in any event, Jesse gets sent with wreckage to Fort Worth, Texas, the home of the 8th Air Force. The 509th was part of the 8th Air Force. Everything is chain of command here. You know,
yes.
Major Marcel reports to Colonel Blanchard, who reports to General Ramey. He's in Texas. While Jesse is flying his stuff in a B-29, he's not the pilot, but General Ramey's chief of staff, Thomas Jefferson Dubose, takes a call from New York, not from New York, Washington, from Ramey's boss, giving him three orders. And I got this directly from Dubose. This is not third-hand information.
Okay.
He was one of the few people who was still alive. Colonel Blanchard was dead. Ramey was dead. I couldn't talk to them. And Dubose told me that General McMullen, they knew each other, both West Pointers, crusty old guy, he said, gave him three orders. He said, I want you to get the press off our back. I don't care how you do it. I want you to send some of that wreckage up here today with one of your colonel couriers, and I don't want you ever to talk about it again, not even with your buddy Roger Ramey. That's an order. Do I need to put it in writing, Colonel? No, sir. When a two-star general tells a colonel
yes.
what to do, he does it. I mean, there's no arguing about things. And so when Jesse comes in, General Ramey says, you don't say anything. I'll take care of it. They brought in some balloon wreckage, radar reflectors that any three-year-old could tear. And what was strange about the material, of course, is that no three-year-old could tear it. You could fold it and fold it and fold it and unfold on its own. And there were light pieces of stuff, the weight of balsa wood, but you couldn't break them, burn them, cut them. Everybody knew about balsa back then, and you could easily cut, burn, break balsa wood. Mm-hmm. Any four-year-old could do that. And Jesse gets sent back to Roswell. Meanwhile, the public information officer put out the press release. The story went all over the country. Too late for the East Coast papers and too late for the rest of the country's morning papers, just in time for the evening papers from Chicago West. And I have headlines from all these papers. A lot of people would have you believe, especially the nasty, noisy negativists, that it was just in the Roswell paper, not a major newspaper. I've got headlines from the Chicago Daily News, from Los Angeles Herald Express, from the Sacramento Bee, from, you know, all Spokane Chronicle, whatever. And the story died a natural death. As a matter of fact, it's kind of funny because the Los Angeles paper had a big headline, Army Finds Flying Saucer. Front page, all across the front. Smaller print, just beneath it, General thinks it's radar weather gadget. The fix was already in the same day.
Yeah.
It's the only paper I know, I haven't looked at the Hawaii papers, that has both the, we found a flying saucer and no, it's just a weather balloon
story
in it. All the papers the next day had Ramey empties Roswell saucer and that was the end of it. Now, there's been so much garbage put out by the nasty, noisy negativists. They make it sound as if the story got a second life because Jesse came running to me. Well, that's nonsense.
No, you. We have an interview where you met him down at the television guy. He said, hey, there's a guy you need to meet down in Louisiana, right?
Yeah, it was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And it was only because a reporter was late and the station manager was embarrassed.
And we have a great story about that on our website. And you need to go there and read the whole thing about what Stanton says. So, in other words, that's the reason I think you're the father of this investigation.
Well, that's better than calling me the grandfather. And I'm going to be a great-grandfather before the end of the year, which makes me really feel
old.
Well,
so am I. I mean, in September.
Good for, it's amazing. Yeah, me too in September. Yeah. Must have been something in the air.
Yeah, you never know. You talk about the – I want to get into this late information here in a moment. And you've been very busy with other things that we've got to bring out. But as long as we're talking about Roswell and we're in Roswell and it's a 60th anniversary, first of all, down at the UFO Museum, you've been very busy. You had a panel last night. Do you have something scheduled for Sunday?
Well, Sunday I have a lecture called Star Travel? Yes! Exclamation point. And I will show pictures of nuclear rockets and nuclear airplane engine and review the whole question. One of my points will be, too many of the people that attack interstellar travel say, well, look how much energy it would take to get to the next galaxy. Well, I don't care about the next galaxy. It's 2 million light years away. I'm interested in the local neighborhood. And within our local neighborhood, within, say, 55 light years of here, there's over 1,000 stars. 5% of them are similar to the sun, might be expected to have planets and life. And I will draw my target for interstellar travel from the Betty and Barney Hill case, where there was a star map observed, and Marjorie Fish, a woman building 26 different three-dimensional models of our local galactic neighborhood, very painstaking work, was able to identify the stars that were in a pattern that Betty saw on board the saucer. And the results are quite remarkable because the base stars turn out to be the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in our entire local neighborhood, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. And I didn't name them. Nobody can blame me for that. They're only 39 light years away, 39 versus 2 million in the next galaxy.
Yes, right.
And secondly, it's quite amazing. Not only are they both sun-like, but they're only an eighth of a light year apart, which means that 35 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. So we're out in the boondocks. I don't mean Roswell. I mean the yes. whole solar system.
Well,
and
maybe
those guys
both.
Got next-door neighbors, you know, which is quite remarkable. And from a planet around one, looking over at the other, it's visible all day long, which would be quite remarkable. We can't see many stars besides the sun during the day. Now, here's the real kicker. Those two stars are a cool billion years older than the sun. So in my lecture on Sunday, I will focus on Friedman's law that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. If somebody's got a little head start on us, they're going to know some things we don't know.
Oh, right.
And I got a shock. I was talking to a couple of college classes at the University of Detroit a couple of years ago, and I was going through how much things have changed the last 50 years. You know, we in our lifetimes have watched a lot of stuff change. I said, when I started work in industry, I was using a slide rule. And I looked around the class, and I got no reaction at all. Any of you know what a slide rule is? Nope. None of the students did. And that was less than 50 years earlier, you know. So in the new book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, I talk about the star map work, but I also refute the many charges that have been made against it by people who don't want it to be true, I guess. And... you know, about the book...
Let's talk about that book, because we have your assistant, your co-author, the lady... Tell me about this, how you got involved with this woman. I should rephrase that.
Yeah, please.
Yeah.
I've known Kathleen Marden for over a decade.
Okay.
She is Betty Hill's niece, and she's also been active in ufology. For Mutual UFO Network, she was in charge of... getting people to be investigators, giving them tests and checking their knowledge and so forth. And we were, I guess the real genesis of it came, we were both asked to be present for an English television company to be at the actual location where the event had taken place in Lincoln, New Hampshire. I'd never been there. I'd been in Betty's house. I met Betty and Barney. That's how old I am. Barney died in 69, you understand. Betty and I had done a number of programs since, and I was the first to publish about the star map and stuff. Anyway, we got together because of this English television company, and we talked about she was interested in doing a book, and I had a lot of suggestions to make. And because of the star map work, and you know, it gave us two different opinions. Her training is in sociology and education. I'm a nuclear physicist. And we hit it off well, and my agent, I think it only took 14 rejections before he found a publisher for a book.
Yeah.
And they've come through very well. And Kathy did most of the work, let's face it. But it's an interesting blend of stuff that nobody knows about, because Kathy has Betty's files, the tapes that Dr. Simon made. She transcribed a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And what people may not know is that the original book, The Interrupted Journey, by John Fuller, which was a bestseller all over the world back in 1966, there was too much material to put all in one book from all these hypnosis sessions. And so John would use one answer that Betty gave to Dr. Simon asking questions. He was a psychiatrist who induced really deep hypnosis so that they could relive the experience. Relive, not retell. That was the important point. And Dr. Simon's background was treating shell shock war veterans. Today we'd say post-traumatic stress syndrome, mm-hmm. I guess. That's a fancier term. But, you know, your buddy's head gets blown off next to you. Some people have trouble with that. And so you have them relive with all the emotional and under deep hypnosis, and you can get through it. So he didn't know about UFOs. He didn't care about UFOs. But here were a couple that had some missing time. And what went on? They remembered seeing the flying saucer, but they got home 2 hours later than they should have gotten home. Something's going on here, you know. So Kathleen has read all the correspondence, has transcribed all the tapes, and you get Dr. Simon asking the same question two or three times under certain slightly different twist kind of thing. Also, you know, the noisy negativist insists that if hypnosis was used, what comes out is what the hypnotist wants the patient to say. He redirects their attention to reflect his views about things. They don't tell you that in Dr. Simon's case, for example, he was trying his darndest to get them to say that it was, Betty had some dreams that she recorded around the same time that had some similar elements to what came out under hypnosis. So Simon constantly kept trying to make them believe that Betty had the dreams and Barney picked up on these, and what he was saying was just a reflection of those dreams. What Kathy does in the book is show very carefully and in detail that that was not true, that Simon's attempts to explain it away as something other than a UFO-related experience just don't work. So we've had a good response so far. The book just went out last week.
Yeah, and the name of the book again is?
Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience.
Now I know she's going to be up at MUFON in Denver.
Yeah, I will be there too. Right. She'll be talking about her paper. You know, MUFON, you got to supply a paper, which appears in the proceedings of the conference. So her paper deals with the new information about the Betty and Barney Hill case. Mine is 60 years since Roswell, which I gave here to a limited version yesterday.
Speaking of giving lectures, this thing at the UFO Museum that we talked about it about 10 minutes ago, 7 minutes ago, that you're doing tomorrow on Sunday, July 8th, what time does that start?
It starts at 3 until 5.
And so people can show up down there, downtown.
Yeah, get tickets at the door. They're charging for some of the things down there for their building fund. They're going to build. Boy, do they need a new facility because there wasn't room enough yesterday.
Right. Aren't you on the board there?
Well, I'm sort of on a board of advisors, and we're starting a new research affiliation, kind of 7 of us, to handle, you know, it is the International UFO Museum and Research Center. But it's been a little short on the research. So there are 7 of us who have been very active researchers to try to look, maybe get some support from the museum and use them. And they're a nonprofit organization, so they can apply for grants and stuff. And try to look at some of the larger scientific problems about UFO research. One thing I'd like to do, might as well give it a plug here, we always talk about racing the Undertaker, about Roswell. I mean, people are, almost all of them are dead, so you better get to them before they die. But I am sure that there are still a lot of people out there alive today who have either first or second-hand information about what happened at Roswell, a grandson, a grandchild, a spouse, whatever. But they don't know where to report it. They're afraid of repercussions if they do say the wrong thing in the wrong place at the wrong time. So one thing I'd like to do is do a mailing to all the major newspapers seeking reports, guaranteeing anonymity, giving them a toll-free number, you know, sort of America's most wanted UFO witnesses kind of thing.
That's a good idea.
One of the things we'd also like to do, and it takes a certain amount of work to handle all the calls you get and stuff, is I'm also working with a man named Frank Fascino on a new book that he'll have coming out called Shoot Them Down, the summer of 1952, the biggest time and busiest time in Project Blue Book history. Sightings over Washington, D.C., radar, and all that stuff.
You know, in one of our shows here in Roswell, we talked in great detail about how many fighter planes perhaps were shot down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, we're not talking one or two incidents.
No, we're talking lots of them. And a general admitted that we scrambled jets hundreds of times to chase UFOs.
There's new information coming out. We're going to ask Stanton Friedman. He's been involved at the UFO Museum. He knew Walter Hout personally, and we'll find out a little bit about that when we come back. And I'm sure there are a few other subjects we want to discuss with Stanton as well. A man we admire, a man who has basically a legend and is well-deserved because, Stanton, the thing I like about you is you're very thorough. And you keep checking and keep checking and coming back. And that's what it takes, really.
Well, I believe in have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear. That's not a popular view, you know. Shoot first, ask questions later is the normal notion.
Great way to go to a commercial break. The facts are on the commercial, folks. We'll be right back.
Oh.
I'm Jerry Pippin. We're here at the Roswell 60th anniversary celebration. I would like to take this opportunity to talk to you about a vacation idea for this summer or really any time that is unique, different, and affordable. I'm talking about a tour of the Grand Canyon in a van with Marvelous Marv, the world-famous tour guide. Marvelous Marv has lived in the Grand Canyon area for well over two decades, and he will show you things that no other tour guide will, and all the while fill you in on the history and the mystery of the giant canyon itself. When you go on a tour with Marv, you get to see the best viewpoints and the best exhibits. He knows this canyon. He knows this area of Arizona. Now on this page, there's a banner you can click on, and it will take you to Marv's website, where you can get all the answers about Marv and his Grand Canyon tour. This is a vacation you will treasure forever. Check it out, won't you? Marvelous Marv's Grand Canyon Tours.